Hey, Mads.
Hey, Brian.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
So you've been on the podcast a few times talking about C# 10, 9, 8, maybe even 7, I think.
Yeah, it goes back quite a while. Yeah,
and those are always even two-parter episodes. But here, tonight, we're going to talk about something else.
We are, yeah. You and I, you know, get together frequently. And at one point, recently, I mentioned to you that I'd been diagnosed with ADHD. And after talking about it for a bit, you asked me if I wanted to come on the podcast and talk about that. And I was like, absolutely no. and thought about it for a bit and then said, okay, sure, we can do that.
Yeah, and I'll say why I asked and why, you know, I kind of requested you to put aside the hesitancy. I said, because of who you are and your position, you're a known person in our community. And if you're going to talk about this, it, I suppose, in a sense, destigmatizes it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is it's a very important thing for people to talk about it. And part of my hesitancy was not just about privacy, although there's always a little bit of vulnerability involved, but it was also actually sort of almost like an imposter syndrome thing where I was like, well, I've only just realized like 6 months ago, like I'm a beginner at this. Like, what can I tell people that will be useful to them? But then, you know, I think you made the excellent point that, well, that is an experience and that is something that you can share. We can always talk about it again in 10 years, you know?
Yeah, I was also thinking that, you know, because it's so new to you, you are, I suppose, experiencing it like a person who doesn't know they have it still, or you're still familiar, those feelings are still there. Whereas if you've been diagnosed and you've been living with it for many years and you understand it, maybe you forget what it was like that long ago.
Yeah, I think that is very true. I don't know yet, but I suspect, yeah.
Because I think it was, so we're recording this 5th of May, and I think it might have been February or January you mentioned it, something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I got my diagnosis last October, so a good 6 months ago, and had suspected for a little while before that. I actually, why I even discovered it was I have a close relative who got diagnosed, and when I was digging in to learn more about it, it just seemed so awfully familiar, and it is very genetic, as you know, maybe we'll return to talking about later. And so there was a good probability that I also had it. It just clicked already in hearing about their specific challenges and also reading up on it based on that. You know, I just, it just seemed very likely. And I went and got diagnosed and I was, you know, fully there, fully, hitting all the marks except for some of the most destructive and self-destructive ones, thank God.
So you said that a relative had it, and then you recognized some of the traits in that relative in yourself. What were some of those traits that you recognized yourself?
Well, it kind of almost like attention deficit is part of, like, ADHD is an abbreviation for attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, if I remember correctly. And the attention deficit, like the fact that I had a really hard time paying attention, was definitely like in there as a top thing. Like I really have a hard time focusing on something for a while, especially the more passive I am, I've had to listen to something for a while. It's almost physically impossible for me. But so that is, you know, that is such a common and distinguished symptom that it's in the name of the disorder. But it is a representative of various forms of, I guess you can call, dysregulation or self-regulation deficiency in a way. Like, it's the inability to just pay attention is one of many. Others are around, you know, emotional regulation and about, a lot of it is about executive function, which is, can I get things done? You know, how good am I at planning? And more importantly, how good am I at actually acting on my plans? and I'm rotten at that. Like, I really, really am very bad at at executing. And so that is also really, you know, a big aspect for me. For different, everyone with ADHD has their own sort of profile of what are the most significant aspects in that, you know, impact them the most in their daily life. And for me, those were definitely some that were right up there.
When you say you have trouble focusing, you know, I look at you and you're running C# at Microsoft for many years. You have a PhD, I presume a bachelor's degree. You know, those are 8-9 years at least of educational focus plus many years of work focus on a single thing. What do you mean when you say you can't focus?
I mean, I have a hard time getting a task done. I have a hard time sitting. For instance, when I took my PhD, you know, you're supposed to write research papers. And that was absolutely painful for me. There were many, many times where I just ended up not submitting a paper because I couldn't get it done in time. And I would sit the whole night before. And then at 6 a.m. in the morning, I would realize I'm not going to be able to finish this. There is sort of an antidote to it, which is fear. whenever something is scary enough for me not to finish, for instance, if I'm really going to disappoint someone, if I don't finish a task, then I can use that, the stress and fear of that, to overcome my lack of execution. Like, it will drive, it will just be an even bigger force than my resistance. And there's sort of this arms race going on, and the fear will often win, but at great cost. You know, I spend a lot of time being stressed and anxious because of that. So a lot of things that I have gotten done have either been because I was scared of disappointing someone, getting put in a super embarrassing situation, or because I was able to outsource or delegate part of the executive responsibility, if you will, get someone else to help me drive it to conclusion.
Well, when you're saying, you know, you have that conflict between the fear and the distraction, or I don't remember quite precisely how you put it, but is that a miserable experience to go through?
Oh, it certainly can be. Yeah, I mean, it can be super painful, and it comes with a lot of kind of self-blame or low self-esteem, if you will. Like, why can't I do these basic things? It's always been clear to me that there were things that I was uncommonly bad at doing, and a lot of them had to do with just do the task, you know, just do the fucking thing. And that's always been, it's really challenging when you're a PM at Microsoft, because it's all about driving processes sometimes. Right. And I mean, they hired me for my language design skills, but I turned out to be a really bad PM in a traditional sense. And I had to sort of make up for it in other ways. Part of which, kind of goes to, the sort of this weird side of ADHD for many people, and that's sometimes referred to as superpowers, where even as there are things that you are uncommonly bad at, there are also things that you're uncommonly good at. They often, you know, again, it's different from person to person, but they're often related to thinking outside of the box, you know, so being innovative and creative. They can be related to emotional intelligence. Like, not everyone is like me, is super scared of what other people think. For some reason, that's always been a big thing for me, and that's it's been hard to overcome. But that also means that you study other people a whole lot, and you get it sort of helps build empathy, if you will, in that you have an easy time connecting with other people's emotions, and you also kind of know what it feels to feel inadequate or feel awkward or difficult in a situation. And I think it often leads to, and for me, it certainly meant that I think I'm fairly good also at social situations and kind of collaboration and making people feel good in a work environment, for instance.
And do you think those are connected to ADHD, or is that simply another part of your personality?
I think they're connected. I mean, obviously there's some base level personality maybe that we all have, but it's hard to kind of, I mean, ADHD to some point is part of my personality, or it's become part of my personality as I've developed as a person. I mean, there are these primary, I think it might be good to think of it as sort of like primary and secondary effects, right? The primary effects are like, this is biological disorder. It's about how your brain is wired. It's not something that has to do with how my parents treated me, unless, you know, they actively banged my head into a wall. It doesn't have to do with childhood trauma or anything like that, typically. It's just how the brain works. And so there are some primary symptoms because of that. They have to do with the fact that my brain doesn't get quite the level of various neurotransmitters that normal, quote unquote, brains do. And there's always a deficit of those. And that has some primary effects to just what's hard for you versus other people. That, like what we talked about with the various forms of self-regulation. But then you grow up with that, your brain actively, you know, both biologically actually evolves differently. That kind of, there's research now to even say that at the biological level, the ADHD affects how the brain evolves during your childhood. But also, of course, you have a bunch of experiences that reinforce certain patterns that become part of your personality, at least become ingrained enough in you, I think, that you can call them part of your personality. Just because you are reacting to, or you're learning from how the ADHD affects your interaction with the rest of the world.
Since you say, you know, it is entirely a brain physiological issue, when you had the suspicions you had ADHD and you went for a diagnosis, what was the diagnosis process?
Oh, that's super interesting, actually, because even though it is now like proven to be completely biological in its origin, right? There's not actually an easy biological level test that you can do. I mean, obviously they found out somehow, so they must have done like some kind of studies and some people and found, you know, where it's all at. But even that is still evolving. There are two ways that I know of that they find out. One is a test where they put you in a dark room and you have to do a very tedious task on a screen, and then they track your movement. And supposedly that can tell them how distractible you are and how hard it is for you to stay with a task over some very long 20 minutes with that machine. I haven't gone through that test myself because I think some swear by it and some find it more or less discredited in that it doesn't tell you anything that you can't tell by the other method, which is they ask you questions and you rate things, you know, you say on a scale from 1 to 5, how hard was it for you as a child to blah, blah, blah. They have a series of questions, you answer them, and then based on that, that's how you get the diagnosis. So it's really about, you know, you answering questions about yourself now and in your childhood.
So when you're looking back at your childhood now, are you kind of reassessing behaviors or incidents through the lens of, oh, I must have had ADHD at the time?
Absolutely. I mean, it to an extreme degree. I will tell you, like, being told that I had an incurable brain disorder should probably have made me feel like devastated or something. I don't know. I was exhilarated. It was fantastic because it was such an aha moment like I've never had in my life before. The size of the penny that dropped, you know, was just earth shattering to me. And because so much in my life all of a sudden came into perspective, like things that I had even kind of, you know, things that were obvious to me and things that I had kind of like brushed away or was too ashamed to even deal with consciously anymore or whatever, it all sort of just like came back as, Oh, now I know. Now I understand what was going on. You know, holy cow, that explains it. So it was almost like quasi-religious in its kind of epiphany aspect. And it's still ongoing, and there's still things where I go like, oh, you know, I return to something. I'm like, there it is. It's because of my ADHD. Of course, I don't mean to say that it's not my fault. It's the ADHD's fault or something. I think it's not an excuse for pretty much anything, because I'm a grown up like anyone else, and I have to take responsibility for my actions, and I do, and I want to, but it's really good to understand that, okay, where something went off the rails, here's a component of it that makes me better understand why I didn't do what I wish I had done, or why I took this particular path, and then you can work with it, and you can think, okay, what can I do now that I understand the mechanism? What can I do to function better in those situations?
Is there one that you could give an example of where you had that, that was ADHD related?
I blame the ADHD. It's always hard to think of a concrete example when you ask.
I know. I hate putting people on the spot like this. Can you tell me a time when?
Yeah, it's like this interview question, right? When was the time when you showed leadership? Well, I did it all the time, but I can't come up with one right now. It's definitely looking back at my childhood, I had definitely had some weird, experiences of being consciously forgetful, if is the best term I can think of. Like I would borrow things from people and I would forget to give them back. I would see them on my shelf and then, or, you know, lying around in my room, and all I would have to do at that moment would be to put them up, you know, pick them up, put them in my school bag if it was like someone from school, and bring them to them the next day. It would be easy. But somehow, between the already being embarrassed that I forgot and the thought of having to hand it over to them tomorrow, and that would be slightly awkward, and that would just stave me off long enough that I wouldn't do it, and I would forget all about it again, you know, 3 microseconds later. And I never really understood what was happening there. It was one of many, many examples where I felt like certain emotional expectations would act almost like a repellent, like a magnet pushing my attention away from something. And they all sort of just click into place when you understand about the emotional dysregulation and the attention issues. It's very easy to distract yourself from something you don't want to do. And it's very easy not to want to do something because I'm going off on a tangent. That's another ADHD trait. There you go. It's very easy to associate negative emotion with something when you have experience of having screwed it up so many times before. Like the ways that you're a screw up because of the way your brain works, that compounds into sort of like an emotional aversion. And that will so easily get you off track from something that feels that you don't really want to do. It's not even about sitting there trying to decide whether to do it or not. Your attention just goes whoosh over to something else and you forget all about it.
It's interesting. You talking about attention and spacing out and distractibility, and I know you're an avid bread baker, but you're a bread baker of the kind that it takes a few days to make the loaf of bread. Whereas I'm the bread baker where I get the instant yeast and it takes me a couple of hours.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's weird because, yes, I have to, when I bake my sourdough, you know, there's three major parts of the process, and they each happen on a subsequent day. And so it's actually, it is challenging for me, but I enjoy it so much that I make myself do it anyway sometimes. But it's only like last time I baked, it had been like a month or a month and a half. So I was a little out of the habit there. And I did the first day thing. And on the second day, I completely forgot about it. I was supposed to do it in the morning. And I only remember it in the evening. And I did it then. And the bread didn't come out quite as good because of that. But, you know, I just completely forgot. I'd been planning my whole day around it. I'd been focusing so much on remembering to do it. But even then, I got up, something distracted me that day. And next thing was I discovered, you know, the leaven sitting there on my kitchen table, you know, as we were starting to look at doing dinner. And I was like, oh, no, I forgot. So that's a typical example.
But that one, again, it just strikes me as so strange because you and I both enjoy making bread. And I know I do not have the patience to do it over 3 days. I absolutely do not. I love the, you know, making it a couple of hours and I'm happy if I get around to it. And now with the weather being so good, I don't even find that. So it's, you know, when we talked first, when you told me about ADHD, it struck me as how can this be reconciled? A 3 day process when I have a, you know, 2 hour process.
That's a good question. Well, first of all, my bread is really, really good.
I look forward to having it sometime.
We still haven't tried each other's bread, but that's a good question, really. That I have to think about that a little. I think that I also, unlike you, I do the same, pretty much the same recipe every time. I change it up a little, but more as sort of like a scientific experiment, moving, you know, changing one variable. And part of it, I think, is that I really need a script. I can't, if, you know, it's too easy for the improvisational thing to get out of hand for me or for me to mess it up. So it's more of this is a way that I keep in control of it. That I happen to settle on a 2 day process thing is maybe semi-random, but the fact that I use the same recipe every time and that I have very strict procedures that I follow, I think it helps me stay on track and helps me do it, you know, keep control.
Control. What other, let's say, upsides do you have for ADHD?
Well, I think we talked about the superpowers a little bit. And I think for, you know, again, it's different for different people, but I think that I am probably really good at thinking outside of the box, of kind of like stepping back and seeing a bigger picture, even with a lack of evidence or something. And I don't know exactly why that is, but I hear it, you know, commonly mentioned when people talk about ADHD. And my best, it might be totally wrong, but my interpretation of it is, in fact, that the lack of control over my conscience, you know, your conscience is a very sort of single track, controlled, analytical thing, right? And to me, it's hard for me to stay in that space. And I think I think that the boundary to my subconscious, which has much more processing power but less analytical skill, is more porous. And I think that things just pour through in both directions more easily. It's just that, I mean, it might be totally not that, but that's kind of how I explain it.
What about things like stress? I mean, we don't want to talk about tech, but you have a very prominent position in C#, you know, there must be an enormous amount of stress associated with that.
There absolutely is. And in some ways, I mean, stress is always bad, but stress has definitely been exacerbated for me through the ADHD and through feeling that there were so many things I wasn't good at. Even as I was kind of, you know, quote unquote, paying my dues by being good at evolving C#, I was, you know, other things made it very stressful that I think I was actually, you know, stress is still a problem for me, but I think in my earlier days, at Microsoft, for instance, I think it was worse because by now I've sort of, people kind of know what I'm, what I suck at, and they're, you know, they accept that, that some things that people normally would do themselves have been delegated at this point that, you know, other people in my position might do themselves. I just let other people deal with that. And I think I've gotten good at delegating in a way that is mutually beneficial. It's not just about, well, here we go again. There's something Mads can't do. We have to do it for him. But that I, you know, it's an opportunity for someone else who's much better at it than me to play a role and to shine there and to get, you know, more of a seat at the table and more, you know, more participation in the, for instance, the C# design process. So I think I've found more and more ways to compensate for the things I find really hard that also make my job, you know, all up less stressful. Also, all my kids are grown now. That also really helps.
Probably helps, yeah. The, I know you touched on this a little bit, but there was a major, let's say, negative impacts ADHD had on you, let's say, before the diagnosis. But were there maybe, I don't know, less prominent impacts to your day-to-day life or relationships?
You mean, well, I think that they're all, we're sort of in the I guess, in the territory of secondary effects, if you will, like kind of sure. things that are, that happen because, that aren't the ADHD, but happen because of the ADHD or like a derived effect of that. And, I think that you ask about relationships specifically. I've definitely had a hard time, you know, that, okay, let's look at this, the low self-esteem and the sort of the anxiety around disappointing people. And what you get when you combine those is that I certainly become a little bit of a people pleaser. And it means that it has meant for me that it's taken me a long time, like way, way into my adulthood, to get enough confidence and learn mechanisms that help me, you know, quote unquote, choose good relationships, like friendships and you know, that kind of stuff, where it's been too easy to sort of just walk up to me and say, I'm your friend now. And, you know, I would just allow people to walk over me because, you know, I didn't have the confidence to think about what is, hey, is this something I want to do? So I guess that's one challenge, not always choosing to be in the most healthy friendships and so on. I think that's one consequence of that.
At some point you had mentioned you have imposter syndrome. I can't remember whether it was on a podcast we made or somewhere else. And since when I heard that initially, I thought, no, surely not. You know, you're at the top of your field. But I was listening to a book recently, and it was saying that quite often imposter syndrome is something that people at the top of their fields have or high achievers. And it's unclear whether it's the cause of them being at the top of their fields or whether it's simply another thing. But I mean, you have said it yourself that you feel like you have imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I think that is part of it too. It's funny that you bring that up now because, you know, less than a week ago, I think last Sunday, I went and saw the excellent author, Neil Gaiman, came in and gave had an event, speaking event here in Seattle. And I went and he again brought up his struggle with the imposter syndrome. And he's absolutely like at the top of his field and super popular and everything's going his way in his field, right? All these TV series coming up and everything. And he still feels that imposter syndrome. And I'm like, yeah, okay. If he can have imposter syndrome, then so can I. You know, it's okay. But it's just this, So I don't know what it's like for Neil Gaiman. I haven't asked him. I haven't had the opportunity. But for me, I think it is. There's a certain sense of not quite belonging. That also, I don't. It's probably a secondary effect as well of feeling a little different. I always feel like I don't quite belong. I'm often, you know, at the edge of a conversation, nodding, but I'm actually not sure what's going on because I forgot to listen to part of it, or because because I don't dare ask the stupid question and just get it cleared up in the situation and so on. And that, so there's always this feeling of not quite being part of the group, lurking somewhere. And I think that is definitely part of it. You know, some people are really good at saying clever stuff where you go like, oh my, I have no idea what they just said, even though I'm supposed to also be an expert here. And B, they must be so much, they must share all this knowledge that somehow I never read because I was too busy being distracted, you know? So it's definitely a thing. An odd thing that often happens to me is, you know, I don't like listening to myself, but I, at least only in real time, but if I read or hear something I said several years ago, I sometimes have this odd feeling of, I was so smart then. That is so, so clever and eloquent what I'm saying there several years ago. I could never do that today. Like it's almost like I can even feel like an imposter in my own life. Like I'm not the Mads that I used to be, or it's very weird. Yeah.
One of the things you touched on there about the kind of, I suppose the edge of a conversation, not quite the same thing, but I remember being at a conference, I think it was in London, and all the attendees and speakers were at the bar, and a very, very well-known speaker who will remain nameless was sitting there and uttered, I think I've used up all my extrovert points. I'm going to bed. And this was a person that I've known for a number of years who was nothing but the most polite, extrovert, talkative, but it was a struggle for them. And they were exhausted at the end of a day and they'd had enough and they said that and off they went. And it's one of those things like what you're saying, from the outside, people like you and that person look like they have all the knowledge, all the experience, all the ability to interact with a crowd, shake the hands, but that isn't necessarily what's going on.
Right. And I think there's definitely some amount of connection. Like, I don't know about this whole introvert extrovert thing. I've never really, it might be one of those things I never really fully understood, and it's just because my brain is, you know, whatever the third option is. but one thing I really understand in that interaction and really connect with is this a sense of exhaustion, like having really, like really being tired and having put in an effort. Some people who are like by their own account naturally introverted, it's not that they can't be extroverted, it's not that they can't enjoy it, but it's just an extra effort for them. And I definitely recognize that. In fact, I think that if you go all the way back to like the biological sort of underpinnings of ADHD, the fact that you don't quite have enough of certain neurotransmitters to really keep the thing going on its own, like in particular, your prefrontal cortex, which is supposed to be your self-regulation, the thing that you know lets you postpone your needs and control your emotions and all that. That is particularly vulnerable to a low level of neurotransmitters, probably because it's so evolutionarily new. Like it's the rest of the brain has been with the mammals for millions and millions of years, and this whole, you know, the prefrontal cortex or whatever it's called, you know, it's a fairly new addition, or at least the role that it plays in our lives is fairly new. And so it's a particularly vulnerable organ. And then when these neurotransmitters like dopamine, for instance, is the most well-known one. When it's not quite at level where things just running by themselves, you have to make an effort. Like you have to get yourself excited, like with anxiety, for instance, or with adrenaline. Like if I'm giving a talk on stage, you know, I'll have a rush of adrenaline before that. And people almost sometimes get worried about me because I get all pale and I look like I'm sick. And I tell them, no, it's just the, you know, the wave pulling back from the shore before it's crashing in. Like it's just the adrenaline building up. And then I can easily overcome the lack of, you know, neurotransmitter mojo, if you will. But it takes extra effort. And every time someone with ADHD needs to use their executive function or pay attention or any of those things, it's more effort than for a normal person. They have to bring up their neurotransmitter level artificially somehow. That's why many of us have tics. Like we will not sit still when we are trying to pay attention, for instance. It's to keep ourselves awake. It's to kind of up the thing a little bit. And every time we do that, every time we have to do that, we spend more energy. It's like an analogy that makes sense for me is we're biking uphill all the time. There's never like a break where we bike downhill because the brain has to work extra hard all the time when we're in these situations where we need our executive function and our attention. And so you get so exhausted from nudging your brain into action all the time. It's the brain is like a lazy teenager. Sorry, teenagers out there. I didn't mean it like that. But it's like you have to poke it all the time for it to just do the things you already agreed you need to do, you know? and it's just hard and you get exhausted. And at the end of the day, you almost can't do it anymore and you have to be alone. And if it's not the same as the extrovert introvert thing, it's definitely very similar. That was a long answer to a short question.
No, but actually you touched on something I wanted to ask you. So the hyperactivity aspect of it, we haven't talked about much, but you mentioned it there, that needing to jolt yourself to keep your brain active. Can you talk more about that?
I could try, but it's not one that's strongly represented in my own ADHD. So I can't say so much about it. I mean, there's something there for me. At some point, within the last 10 years, an innocent and sweet comment on a video of me doing a talk mentioned my little wiggle I do when I explain things. And I was like, I do a wiggle? And my colleagues were like, yeah, you do. Yeah, I mean, you have like a dance. You have your explanation dance. And I'm like, I had no idea. And I do this on video. And I got very self-conscious about it for a bit. But it's one of those tics that I'm, if you look at me on a video, I'm a little jittery. I'm dangling like a, you know, like a puppet. You know, there's that little sort of extra tension in my body that I can't quite relax and sit still. Especially if I'm standing, it's easier to keep under control if I'm sitting down. But that is definitely some of that. That is me sort of keeping my body in an alert state and unconsciously moving because of that. I'm sure of it. But for some people, the hyperactivity gets to be a real problem, like where it actually interferes in their lives. And when you say ADHD, a lot of people associate it with school age boys, you know, not being able to sit still in class, being disruptive, quote unquote, in class. And again, I mean, it's the way that they can cope with being there in this intensely boring environment or like monotonous environment. And that there's just no way there's no other way that they can deal with it. They, as they grow older and they learn, you know, most of us get some amount of handle on our ADHD compared to when we were kids. Like we grow our executive functions even as all people do as they grow up, just a little slower. But especially in children, you know, it can be very pronounced. And it was one of the first ways that ADHD became widely known in sort of public discourse was, oh, these boys, they can't sit still. And it's probably, you know, the all the additives in there, in the sweets that their parents give them way too much of or something. There are all these like rubbish explanations for it that when the answer was much simpler, it's just that that's how their brains are wired. And we got to help them, meet them where they are and help them with that. Or, you know, make the classroom more amenable to movement. That's a tall order, you know. Help them get exercise in between classes so they're more, you know, so they get some of the jitters out. That exercise helps a lot with ADHD, you know. There are various ways that you can accommodate if you understand what it is. But, yeah.
No, I remember school, you know, sit still, fold your arms.
Yeah.
That was it, you know, year after year. That was what the teachers told us.
Those kinds of things that, you know, can be torture to anyone. But to someone with ADHD, it's especially the pay attention, you know. It's like, I'm trying all that I can, but I can't help disappointing you because I am just not good enough at paying attention. I just don't have it in me. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's not an act of will. It's like, it's just the brain only has so much of it.
Yeah. If we wind the clock back about 6 months to your diagnosis, what was your treatment then?
So I think there's some aspects to treatment. And the first big thing was just the aha moment itself and the reinterpretation of many things in my life already gave me a lot of kind of things to work with that I can just like, I can better compensate when I know what I'm up against. And I think that it came pretty quickly to, I got some good sparring with my family to recognize more and more situations and start just, you know, trying to change habits and catch it before it, you know, it leads to a bad situation. So that was probably number one. And of course, just gathering information, learning, getting a better and better understanding of it. But then I tested out for medication, and I'm now on stimulant medication, which is working very well for me. So the idea is that you can, since the biological factor at play here is that your neurotransmitters aren't quite firing at high enough level, there are medical ways of boosting that. And the easiest one to boost is the dopamine deficiency. You can take a stimulant. There are a couple of different on the market. People know Ritalin by name, probably, or Adderall. Those are the two main. Those are brand names for the two main kinds of drugs that are out there. There are many other brands. And what they do is they enter your bloodstream. They lift up the level of those neurotransmitters for a certain period of time. They leave your bloodstream, they're out. It's a kind of medication that takes almost no buildup and almost no wind down if you want to stop them. So that is, if that works for you, that it really has the benefits of just providing, you know, leveling the hill so I have to bike uphill anymore. It's just, I can just like bike straight like everyone else for some hours. My brain just gets a little boost there. It's like an electrical motor on the bike or something. I don't know. That works super well for me in that I have a much easier time keeping focus while I'm medicated, and I have much less, for some reason I don't quite yet understand, I have much less anxiety about those things that I don't want to do. If I meet a thing that I don't want to do that I have to do, I am less likely to push it as far down the pile. You know, there's still some of it, but I'm much more likely to just say, you know, what the hell? Let's do it. Let's just do it and be able to. So it's fantastic in that way. It really has, for me, it really has changed the game without as far as I can tell, having any impact on my personality. A lot of people are scared of medicine kind of messing with your personality. And I know that happens sometimes with various, forms of, at least people say that they change to a different person or with various forms of psychopharmaca. So for now, that's a good treatment for me. It helps me get over some things. It does mean that I need to try to change some habits. I find that I am not very good at taking breaks when I don't get distracted all the time. When I get distracted all the time, I will naturally take breaks. I'll be in the middle of writing something important, and all of a sudden I find myself two floors down in front of the coffee machine. I'm like, how did I get here? I don't even need coffee. But my brain told me to take a break and go down there instead because the thing was a little uncomfortable, you know? And now I don't do that anymore. And so a challenge for me now is to not just sit there for 3 hours and do focused work and, you know, be physically sore and worn out, not from trying not to do work, but from actually doing the work in a totally different way. And I need to just learn to take breaks and get water and remember to go to lunch and all those things. That's a little bit of a challenge with it. But other than that, it's great. It's really a game changer for me. But it doesn't work for everyone. There are other medications, and often when one doesn't work, another one will. But there's still like some percentage of people, adults with ADHD, where no known medicine will help them. And they will just have to, deal with it in other ways.
So do you have kind of a specific amount to take it per day, or do you take as you need? Oh, I'm losing my attention, I'll take one.
Both are possible. Immediate release versions that you take and they work for like 4 hours, and you can take them as needed if you like that. I'm on one that's extended release, so I only have to take it in the morning, and it sort of gradually releases throughout the day. There's some curve to it, where it kind of peaks around noon for me, and so I shouldn't get coffee at noon, because then when that stimulant stacks on top of my peak medication level, it's actually a little too much stimulant. I actually get a little jittery like normal people do with coffee. So that kind of works for me, because then I don't have to think about it more than once. It just, remember, when I get up in the morning, I'm not medicated, and that means I have full ADHD and I'm sleepy. And that means, and I may be, distracted by something I need to think about or whatever that's going on. Just remembering to take that pill and breaking the attention deficit for the day can be a challenge. Like there'll be days where I forget, or I remember sort of last minute before it, it's too late in the day to take it and it would ruin my sleep. That's a whole side story about how hard it is for people with ADHD to manage the whole medication thing, because it's the stimulants I'm talking about, they're too closely related to meth and illegal substances, and so they're controlled substances, and it's a challenge to get them. You can't just have them auto renew at the pharmacy, and you have to do things in person that normally you could do with an app or something, and the people who have to do that to get their medication are the ones that have the least executive function on the planet. And so and you have to do check-ins with your doctor, and so it's a challenge in and of itself to just get to where you're medicated enough that you can do those things. So there's a bit of a catch-22 there. But that was a tangent that I can't recover from.
Are you doing anything else? Are you kind of changing your habits in life? How you your amount of sleep? Are you taking up meditation? Getting therapy, anything like that?
I'm trying a few of those different things. Meditation is something I find really hard to do. And I think the distractibility is part of that, but it's actually really good for you when you can't do it, because it helps quieten down that chaotic mind. It helps kind of take care of some of the hubbub of different things that you're thinking about all at once, so in rapid succession. So I've been trying, but I haven't been very successful yet. I want to get to where I can do it better. Exercise helps, like we talked about, and really does for me as well. And that is actually probably the best form of meditation for me. If I go for a run in the woods, the leaves, the birds, the wind, kind of can get me into a meditative state that I can't otherwise get into, and it really relaxes my brain. There are definitely things about how you eat. Easy carbs aren't good for anyone, but they're even worse for people with ADHD. And kind of trying to get your energy levels level is more important for us, even, because we're so vulnerable to getting off track or to these, you know, energy challenges in executive function.
You've mentioned the analogy of biking uphill, how it used to be, and you've never biked downhill. Now that you're on the medication, what's it like?
Well, it's definitely more even. And it's a great feeling that some things, you know, I will still sometimes be presented with something I need to do. And my, you know, from prior experience, I will just know, oh no, this is one of those. And then I can just do it anyway. And it's like, well, it looks like a hill because I'm used to this kind of thing being a hill, but actually it's not, you know, or I don't know where the analogy goes, but me, you know, actually I have the motor on my bike now, so I can just go up the hill as if it was, you know, maybe that's the analogy. So while I'm on medication, it helps with that. When I'm not, I think it's too early to say if it's also changing outside of the reach of the medication. I'm doing it most days, especially work days. And so I don't really have a good comparison of whether it's also improving my unmedicated executive function or feeling of, you know, expending effort. That's something I still have to learn, I think.
You said at the start that this is the first time you're talking publicly about this, but with the people around you, family, close friends, what has been a response?
I think on the whole, it's super supportive and even curious. Obviously, with a family, there's a genetic component, so people are really interested in it to see if it also applies to them, as they should be. If you're listening out there, but I've also been increasingly open about it. For instance, at work, I've decided not to make a secret of it. While I'm not sort of like becoming a crusader for ADHD and like making it my persona in public or anything like that, I also decided I don't want this to be some dark secret. I really don't. And I found that as I've been open about it at work, even in sometimes in casual conversation, I'll mention it, I'll think of it, and instead of stopping myself from mentioning it, I stop myself from stopping myself, and I mention it anyway, with the purpose of normalizing it for myself and others as much as possible. But what also happens when I do that is that much more often than I would have thought, somebody will say, hey, I'm actually also recently diagnosed with ADHD. I'm really glad you bring it up. You want to talk about it more, you know? And so I find that being open is the way that you can sort of organically run into others that have the same challenge. That's a really good feeling. So I've decided that there's just no way that it's bad for me to share this, and it's good for everyone that us who have it, we share it as much as we're comfortable. So I should do that. And in particular, I should say, as someone who has, you know, who comes on your podcast, and so some people listen to me for other reasons anyway, I have more reach with that openness. And even though I'm still a beginner when it comes to ADHD, and I don't have a whole lot of expertise there, just the fact that I'm on here talking about it, maybe that, you know, maybe that helps someone out there go like, okay, if he can talk about it, you know, I can talk about it too. Or what he's talking about there, that seems very familiar to me. Maybe I should go get checked out. And yes, you should go get checked out. It's really, I really recommend it.
You touched on it again, the genetic aspect to ADHD. Do you now look back on memories of relatives where you go, oh, that thing that happened, that was ADHD?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, without mentioning names, you know, for instance, there have been some instances of alcohol abuse, alcoholism, in my family's past. And you know, it's a common thing to self-medicate, and you know, along with some other personality aspects of those people, it totally makes sense to me that they probably, especially because I'm, you know, directly descended from them as well, you know, they probably had challenges too, and they didn't, there was no word for it, and there was no, you know, and in these cases they were men, you know, you weren't supposed to talk about difficult things, and so they would struggle with not understanding their emotional dysregulation, maybe being harsh to people in their lives, and feeling that low self-esteem and the self-blame from being much bigger assholes than they thought they should be, or from failing to achieve the things that they thought they should be able to. And it's very common that you will then try to self-medicate, take the brunt off of that, and, you know, with alcohol or other things. That's usually a bad thing, but it's common, and I kind of reinterpret some of the, you know, people I've known maybe, but also that my older relatives have told me about, that I'm like, oh, okay, I think there's a new interpretation model here that we could apply that would actually, you know, let us understand those people better in hindsight.
If some of the people listening recognize what you've been talking about in themselves, what would you suggest they do?
Well, absolutely, you know, get wise. there is a big, big, big reward in finding out, you know, if you actually have it, in finding out that you do. That's certainly my experience. If, you know, so ultimately what I would say is go to a doctor, say, I think I have ADHD, I would like to be evaluated for it, and get that diagnosis in whichever way you can. And if you get it, you know, then now a whole world of possibilities is opening up for you, not just in terms of medication and whatnot, but also in terms of the changes you can make because of that awareness. I mean, that is life changing, and you can really, really get a good life with this. And many of the things that suck for you today and that feel like they're so ingrained in your life that you can never shake them, well, you actually can. You know, it can actually really, really make things better for you if ADHD symptoms are directly or indirectly what's causing the challenges that you have in your life. So
you mentioned going to a doctor. Are you saying a regular doctor, or is it someone more in the mental health side?
They will send you to a specialist. So it will be on the mental health side. Some, you know, I live in Seattle, which is a big city, so there are like ADHD specialists here. You know, that's not necessarily available to everyone. That's why I'm a little vague about it. But if you have a feeling and you go to like your general practitioner and they try to talk you out of it, it's nothing, you know, just that, you know, you got to pull yourself together. There's so much stigma and so much like misinformation out there, even still in like the medical profession. Don't listen. You know, if you have a feeling you need to get sorted out, find that specialist. And I know healthcare can be expensive for some people, depending on, especially in the US with the, you know, the wide variety of different insurance or lack of insurance. But if you want to spend money on anything, getting the diagnosis, I would say it's the thing that really, really has the, the transformative power. And yeah, that can be a couple hundred bucks or whatever, depending on where you are. And that's a lot of money. But if you get that, there's so much, once you have that diagnosis, there's so much free information available, good quality that books, but also a lot of good quality free content available that can help you understand further. And there are actually some things that if you're not ready to go and do that, or if it's not you, but you know someone, or, you know, there's some very, very accessible resources out there. And I probably haven't found them all, but the ones that really clicked for me, and I'll give you some links, Brian, and you can maybe put them up. But there are a few that I find are sort of instantly consumable and that click immediately with me, even before I was diagnosed. It's like, yes. One is a YouTube channel called How to ADHD, which is kind of, the short little tidbits. They're like less than 10 minutes each on a given subject. Very stimulating, like loud music, quick speaking, lots of colors and animations and so on. Speak in very plain language. It's someone named called Jessica McCabe that runs them. And I found that they were really, really good first introductions to some of the concepts involved. And I really felt seen, even if it's sort of very pop, you know. And I think even, you know, quite young children would still get something out of it because it's very plain spoken and very direct and holds your attention well. I would also recommend someone called Danny Donovan, who is a content creator. She's most famous for her cartoons or posters about ADHD, and she shares them on Twitter, for instance, that are just spot on. And they, you know, I feel so seen whenever I look at those. They're just really genius. And many, many people, including I've heard medical professionals, like, they all bring her up. Like, she's like the hero of ADHD themed posters, you know. She's so spot on. So those are some like very easily consumable things. Maybe I can mention one more. There's a podcast series called Ologies, and it has a long double episode about ADHD, which is half a really good insightful professor and author called Russell Barkley that explains in a super accessible way, like all the biology behind and the statistics and so on behind ADHD in the first episode. And the second one is then focused on living with ADHD and brings in, among others, Jessica McCabe, I mentioned before, like brings in several people who discuss the various aspects of having a good life with ADHD. So those are really good first resources, and then you can take it from there. They link to other things if you want to go deeper, and that, you know, lots and lots of great stuff to find out there.
I'll include all those links in the podcast and on the website. What's next for you with ADHD, Mads?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm tempted to say, get my shit together, but that's what I always think is next for me through my whole life, and I never quite get there. You know, next week will be normal, and then I will, you know, get some really good habits and just sort of start living the normal life. And that never seems to happen to me, and that still never happens even after I'm aware of ADHD and being treated for it. So I'll just keep tinkering, experimenting, being open about it, learning things, sharing what I learn. Just try to stay curious about it and not just settle into whatever, you know. Chances are, even though you can hear that I'm much happier than I was before, chances are that there's still things for me to improve, and I will only gradually even get to where I realize myself what are the things that are still not working so well, and then experiment with how to improve them. So I'll keep tinkering with it for the rest of my life, I guess.
Maybe in a year's time or something, we could do another episode like this to see how you're feeling about it, what's changed, what feels new or different.
Yeah, I'd be open to that, you know, assuming that this one isn't a disaster. And I will become a recluse from now on.
No, I must say, I very much appreciate your time and openness with this. And I hope this is of benefit. You know, if this is of benefit to just a single person out there and they go off and it improves their life, that for me is the reward of these kinds of episodes.
Oh my God. Yeah, that would be fantastic. And even if not, you know, just that if people made it this far in and they're, you know, they could get a little more appreciation at the next level for their fellow human beings. You know, honestly, when I go through life now, there are many kinds of neurodiversity. This is one, ADHD falls under the umbrella of neurodiversity, along with autism and learning disorders and OCD and whatnot. And sometimes when you come across things where people struggle or something isn't, you know, doesn't add up for you or feels strange, that certainly happens to me, that even though, as I say, you know, people have to take responsibility for their lives no matter what, you can still have a, like, you know what, there could be neurodiversity at play here in so many ways. You know, just don't be quick to judge. You know, be part of leaving enough space for all of us to be our true selves is to try not to judge, to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Tolerant isn't maybe the right word, but be open and curious to the fact that the way people are different might reflect something in their brains that they can't help, or that they can help, but they are not at the stage yet where they understand that they have it or know how to do something about it. And to be clear, not all neurodiversities have medicine you can just take like I can do. You have to live with it the hard way or find other ways of coping or have your world arranged more around you through accommodations. And that's fine too. So keep that. If you walk away from here being a little more open to, you know, letting it flow through you when there's weird behavior or strangeness, and not having it scare you away or be judgmental, or that in and of itself would also be great.
I think on that positive note, we'll call it a night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mads. It's been great.
Thank you, Brian. This was so different, but great.
Yeah. No, for me too. I mean, I was saying at the start, this is going to be, I think, episode 164. This is the first episode I've been nervous about since maybe episode 10. So I hope people enjoy this.
Well, I can honestly say that this has also been the episode I was most nervous about.
Well, thanks again. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
The opening music was returned by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Below the Surface by Kyle Preston from the album Geo.